It's customary to stand up when you do introductions, so I'll do that even though the lectern's not working. My name's David Webb. I'm the director of the Financial Markets Group, and we're hosting this public lecture today by Robert Shiller, who's on my right. We're very happy to have here with us, although he did give a lecture here last year on housing, which went down very well. The lecture is sponsored by Princeton University Press, who I think you should be able to see their logo here. I can't see it myself. It's a great honor to have Bob Shiller with us. I've certainly taught a lot of his writings to students at the undergraduate and graduate level, some of it in this room, in fact, for many years. Bob Shiller is a very distinguished economist who's influenced all of us in the way we think about financial markets. Early on, he got us to think more than perhaps a lot of us wanted to about the nature of volatility in stock markets. And what made Bob's work so much more powerful and consequently more influential was the rigor with which it was undertaken. Bob's work is always executed according to the highest standards of economic analysis, and the econometric work is always extremely well done and challenging. But for a long time, he's been asking economists to think a lot more about the role of behavior in financial markets and to think more seriously about the insights from the cognitive sciences. And for a long time, he's had a large number of people agreeing with him and possibly a larger number of people disagreeing with him. But I guess that the book Irrational Exuberance, which of course is a title taken from a statement of Alan Greenspan, couldn't really be better timed, because all of us are finding it extremely difficult to use conventional theory based on the efficient markets hypothesis to explain what we see happening in financial markets today. And that's not just what's happening to the dot-coms and the technology stocks, but across the board, finance theorists and empiricists are feeling very challenged by what we see. So it's not just that he's a, according to both Barron's, a party pooper, and to the original Observer, who may be represented here, also a party pooper. Could do better than that. But he's also, apparently, according to Barron's, Dr. Doom. He has a colleague at Yale, it's Roger Ibbotson, I think, is it? Mm-hmm. Who I think takes a completely opposite view of the world. So you're challenged locally. I think he said that the stock market was going to reach 100,000 within 20 years. That's the US Dow. Believe it if you wish. Well, Bob comes to us today, having started life, at least at an undergraduate, at the University of Michigan. He obtained his PhD at MIT, and he's had a very distinguished career at Yale University. And today he's going to talk to us about the book. He'll talk for about 30 minutes, and then what we're going to do is open it up for a discussion. And I can't imagine that a topic like this won't actually invite quite a lot of questions. But when we come to questions, I like the questions to be reasonably well thought out. I mean, I don't think Bob's here to give you personal investment advice, although maybe you could ring him up at Yale and he's willing to part with his knowledge for a fee. But there's some exciting issues going to be raised here, and we look forward to hearing about them. So over to you, Bob.
I don't know if I like Dr. Doom, which is, although I might say my teenage sons thought that was pretty neat. So I'm only going to talk for, I hope that's readable. But if it isn't, we'll manage it. Can you hear me? And can you read that? So I'm only going to talk for less than a half hour and open it up to questions. I think questions or comments or criticisms. As you said, the title of this book comes from a talk that Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, gave in December of 96. And actually, he only used the word irrational exuberance once, and it was in a question, which was something like, How do we know whether the stock market is going through irrational exuberance? And despite the this being an awfully innocuous thing to say, markets all over the world drop. They drop sharply in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Frankfurt, Paris, London, and New York. So it had quite an effect. The question is, why did that simple question have an effect all over the world? One view is that, well, it was that Greenspan was just giving some indication that the Fed might tighten credit. But I don't think that's the reason. I think it's rather more because people are concerned about the possibility that the markets might be doing something that's called, that could be called showing irrational exuberance. And a lot of people are concerned about that. And so when someone like Alan Greenspan gives approval to this view, it has an effect. This, incidentally, is also his most famous quote. And when the next edition of Bartlett's quotations come out, that's what's going to be in there. So I think actually, although he only stated it as a question, he was right in his premise that the markets are in something that we might call irrational exuberance. And I prefer that term to other terms that are commonly used, like speculative mania or speculative orgy, because they kind of overstate. There's a tendency for people who are interested in market psychology to overstate the case, and they lose credibility. It doesn't sound right. But exuberance is just about the right word. So the problem is there's a lot of newspaper and magazine articles that claim something, that there is something going on in the markets that's excessively exuberant, but they tend, I find, not to be too convincing. So what I wanted to do in this book was write a treatise on the topic and amass all of the evidence that I could. There's a lot of difference of opinion about the level of the market, especially now, and usually, and people have different convictions about it. Usually when there's such a difference of opinion, it's because different people are aware of different facts. So I tried to lay out a complete case that presents the entire facts. I argue also in the book that the stock market level is a very important national and international issue. It affects society at large in fundamental ways. When the market is overvalued, it distorts economic decision making. One effect is that people today are less concerned about their other sources of income. They're preserving their human capital, their skills, their job position. They tend to feel that, well, we're all rich, or we can all get rich through the stock market. There's also a tendency not to save much, feeling that we've got all this wealth in the stock market. And I think there's not enough attention paid to designing social insurance. Now there's a hope that we can solve the Social Security problem by investing in the stock market, rather than looking at the issues, the serious issues of maintaining our livelihoods. So I began work on this book in 1987, a long time ago, and I was interrupted. I don't know if you remember what happened in that year. My timing wasn't as good that time, so I set it aside. Well, the stock market crash of 1987 occurred. When that happened, I thought, this is, in a sense, it's bad in a way, but in a sense, it's wonderful because it offers a chance to study stock market crashes. 1929 crash is beyond us, but here we have a new one. And I've often believed, long believed, that economists do not ask people why they do things often enough. Milton Friedman said, you should never ask, because people will never tell you the truth or are incapable of telling you. But I think somebody ought to ask. So I sent up questionnaires on the week of the crash, asking people what they were thinking, why they were buying and selling. I sent out 3,000 questionnaires to individual and institutional investors, and I got back 1,000 responses. So in a nutshell, what happened in October 1987? Well, what I concluded was that it wasn't really a reaction to any news. I asked about all the news events that were in the newspaper on the morning of the crash, and I got bland, uniform responses. Everything that was in the news was important. But when I asked open-ended questions, you name the news story, they didn't name news stories. They either said the market's overpriced, believe it or not, that was a common theme in 1987, Or they said something about market psychology, or people are going crazy, or something like that. And what appears to have but the most important story that they mentioned was the price declines themselves. So what it appears happened in October of 1987, partly due to portfolio insurance, but also substantially to individual and institutional investors' behavior, is a feedback loop. Initial price declines attracted attention and caused further price declines because people sold in response to the price declines. And the form it took on that day was nobody could figure out what was happening. You heard about the price declines in the morning, and you knew that there were bad price declines last week. So you called your broker, and the broker said, "I don't know what's going on." You talked to a number of friends. Nobody could tell you what was going on, and you had to reach a decision. And on that day, the decision for more and more people was to sell. And the question all day long was, when is it going to turn around? And there was absolutely no answer. No definitive answer. So it was just anybody's guess, and it stopped when people started to guess that it was going to turn around. That's a downward feedback loop. Now, I argue in the book that part of what's going on now is a reverse. It's an upward feedback loop, that price increases have been generating investor interest, and that generates more price increases. And this is operating over a slower time frame, over years, and maybe a little bit different, but it can go either way. So, as I said, this book is attempting to be a treatise on the market, so I tried to be systematic in about the current stock market level. And these are the chapters in the book, and I can't do them all justice in this short talk, but the first chapter, I talk about the stock market level in historical perspective and argue that we are in a record high, almost unique, maybe unique, stock market experience right now. Then in part one, I talk about structural factors. And the first thing is precipitating factors. And this is something that's very important to ask. What ultimately is different that caused us to be in this situation? It's not enough to say that there's feedback, because you might say, well, why is it any different now than other times? And this is where a lot of accounts, I think popular accounts of the irrational exuberance, fall short. They kind of suggest that we all went crazy recently, and we know that's not true. Something had to cause this. Okay. And I argue here that there are many precipitating factors, actually, not just one. History is complicated, and usually when major historical events occur, it's because of many factors all operating, and the confluence of these many factors causes the major effect. If you remember, why did the Roman Empire fall? Gibbon wrote a treatise on that. Some of you may have read it, but you probably can't think of the one-liner about why it fell. How history is complicated like that. And that's why it continues to puzzle us and amaze us. Nonetheless, I think I can come up with a list of factors. Amplification mechanism, that refers to the feedback that I was saying. So cultural factors. I argue that the news media are essential to any speculative bubble. Part of the form it takes is new era economic thinking. Professional economists will tell you after a stock market boom why it is that we are experiencing and why we're entering a new era. And the remarkable thing is that if you look at the history of, there's many, many speculative bubbles in history around the world, and each of them has its new era theory. And when you see them in, one after the other, it gives you a better perspective on the new economy that we are coming into now. Psychological factors, I talk about evidence from psychology, research by psychologists about limitations of human judgment that we have to bear in mind to judge the plausibility of some of these irrational exuberance theories. I talk about herd behavior. And that kind of is the case, the basic case. Then I come back and reply to critics. There's the famous efficient market theory in finance that says that the stock market is wonderfully efficient. It's associated with the random walk hypothesis, and it says that prices incorporate all information optimally. And there's a whole list of arguments that are interpreted as supporting this theory, but I regard the theory as only a half-truth, and it doesn't take away from the fact that we are going through a strange period, irrational period right now. Chapter 10 is about investors learning. A lot of people think that people have suddenly gotten smart. And I question that everyone is suddenly getting smart. Irving Fisher in 1929 made the same claim. It's a beautiful passage I could read to you from him, which he says, people are much more sophisticated about investing now. They're not vulnerable to panics, and they know that the stock market has always outperformed other investments. But I think that the apparent learning is really actually part of the feedback mechanism, that the new facts are much more current because of the situation in the market. And finally, I come back to a call for action, the outlook and actions to take. That basically is get out of the market if you're an individual, or not be so reliant on the market. Save more. And I mentioned before, the government should maybe encourage saving and should reform Social Security. But let me get on to the first chapter about the situation. I think this picture, this is the U.S. stock market, kind of tells the story. This is the Standard & Poor's stock price index corrected for inflation, measured by the CPI, from 1871 to January of 2000. Okay, this is the official Standard & Poor's index, Bureau of Labor Statistics price index. So it's standard, but you don't see it plotted for the whole period in real terms very often. Now, I don't know if you notice what I intend you to notice in this diagram. Kind of anomalous behavior. That's not a plotting error. This is around 1994, 1995 here. And here's where Alan Greenspan made his statement, incidentally. And the market looked pretty extraordinary. But you can see what it did what it did since. So it tripled, essentially, in the last 5 years. And when was the last time that the U.S. stock market did that? Well, the last time that it tripled to a regular level. It's right here. Do you know what this is, this period? This is 1929. So it tripled from 24 to 29. And there's really no other experience where it went up quite this dramatically. So I think we're in a... No, the other thing to note, I've got here the S&P earnings data, which is the earnings for the index, and also in real inflation-corrected terms. And now look at that. Now you can see that earnings have done better. This is the 91 recession. They were depressed by the recession. They came out of the recession, and then they kept going up. So they look good. They look above trend. If you were to fit a trend line through here, you know, it would probably go like that. They look a little above trend. But, you know, the price response seems to be more extraordinary. This is the thing that's really puzzling, that prices move a lot more than earnings have. I have here stock price indexes for five countries. And you can see that it's not specifically a U.S. phenomenon. Here's the U.K. It's only doubled in the last 5 years. That's still dramatic, but it's not. And we've got France and Germany up there with the U.S. They've really done the same thing. It's not everywhere, though. However, here's Japan. And you can see that it's fallen in half instead of gone up over that period. So it's not quite a worldwide phenomenon, but it's an international phenomenon. Here is the price-earnings ratio in the United States, going back to 1881 to the present. And I actually compute the price-earnings ratio in a way that's not conventional today, but is actually the way that was recommended in 1934 by Graham and Dodd. They wrote a classic securities analysis textbook in 34, and they said that people usually compute price-earnings ratios by dividing price by last year's earnings, but since last year's earnings is so volatile and it tends to be depressed in recession, so you tend to get high price-earnings ratios in recession, they said you should average the earnings over 5, or they said as much as 10 years. So that's what I've done here. This is the real price divided by the 10-year average of the real earnings. So this diagram is derived from the one you just saw. And you can see that there are really four peaks, 1901, 1929, 1966, and 2000. So in each of those peaks, the market did poorly afterwards. When you have a ratio, price divided by earnings, it can come back to its normal level, which is around 15, either by the price going down or the earnings going up. So guess which one it is. Efficient markets theory would say it's got to be earnings going up because price is a random walk and can't be predicted. But in fact, it's not. As John Campbell and I showed in another paper, it's because the price goes down. So here's a scatter diagram using, on the horizontal axis, the current price earnings ratio that I just plotted. But for the years 1881 to 1989, the last year for which I had 10 subsequent years of data. And here's this annualized subsequent return over the next 10 years. And the point is that there's a negative relation. When PE was low, the lowest it got was around 5, that was 1920. The return per year was over 15% in real terms. But in other cases, this is only January data. Here's 1929, but it was January of 29. If I took September, it would have been negative subsequent returns. But it seems like there's a pattern. And Campbell and I, this is what we actually testified before the Federal Reserve Board 2 days before Greenspan's speech, irrational exuberant speech. And we showed plots like this for a number of countries. So it seemed to be a pattern that when things are high, they come down. And I've been accused of influencing Greenspan to make that speech, but it's actually his term and not mine, irrational exuberance. So the point is that it looks like, from these data, there's an important lesson here. We've been told for many years that the random walk hypothesis is a good approximation. But you got to remember that those people who are saying that are talking about daily data and not talking about this kind of long term data. Over the long horizon, it doesn't look right at all. It looks like when the price is high, it comes down, and when it's low, it goes up. And that's what the data show. So the data don't support, they do not suggest a random walk. So now, okay, having established that we're in an unusual situation in the markets, what are the reasons, ultimately, why we're in a different situation? And these are my precipitating factors, and I've got a dozen of them. Now, these are for the United States, but most of these apply in Europe and other places as well. I don't have time to cover them all. Let me just mention the first one. The Internet, actually the World Wide Web, became available to the public in 1994. I'll show you if I can get my plot back. Maybe I won't be able to get it back. Here it is. This is the World Wide Web. Right around here it came in. So it's suggestive. The World Wide Web is viewed by many people as an important technological advance. And correctly so. It is one of a series of important technological advances that we've seen in history. The Bessemer process for steel, the railroad, the airplane, the automobile, the telephone, the telegraph, I suppose, the nuclear power. You can even talk about other ones that sound smaller by comparison, but maybe as important as the web, I think, if you look at them. The expressway, superhighways, or jet engines on aircraft might be as important as the web. They're all important, but somehow the World Wide Web has made a very strong impression on the market. And I think that the reason is that the World Wide Web is something that we use every day and have experience with at a level different from that of these other inventions. Most of us are on the web, or many of us are on the web every day, and we're doing things. We're not passive. We're getting things done on the web, so we see the power of it. In contrast, I wonder how many people here have ever operated a nuclear reactor. And even if you did you do it every day for a period of years? I think it's that another thing is that it came at the same time that we were recovering from the recession of 91. So we saw a lot of earnings growth at the same time. But of course, that earnings growth had nothing to do with the World Wide Web. So it has it's a plausible sounding reason to expect a new era. I won't go through all this. Let me just mention one the baby boom. In the United States, after World War II, there was a lot of babies born. And they're supposed to be middle-aged now and buying stocks. That's basically the theory. Here's the data for the U.S. It's the X's. You can see this is the U.S. It went way up. And it stayed up, and then after around the mid-60s, it fell. But it's not really a worldwide phenomenon, because you don't see it in so strongly in France, Germany, Japan, or the UK. The thing you do see is that, and this is a very important worldwide phenomenon, the birth rate is dropping in most developed countries. So that might mean that the market is going to go down when these people retire. Harry S. Dent has made a career of he now charges $50,000 a lecture, I'm told, to tell the story of how you're going to get rich in the stock market by buying now and selling in before the year 2008, when he says it will crash. I think Harry S. Dent is an important a factor as some of these others in boosting the market, because the baby boom is constantly coming up and people thinking about the market, they think it can't go wrong because you have all these baby boomers with their demand for stocks. Okay, amplification mechanisms. I mentioned the feedback, but let me just give a little bit of evidence about it. The feedback, I believe, operates in a number of channels, but one of the channel, a couple of, one of them is expectations, and the other one is confidence. I have some evidence here about confidence. What I'm saying is the experience of seeing prices rise again and again, really since 1982, but especially in the last 5 years, seeing every drop reversed, has created a strong sense that the market can only go up. So these are some questionnaire items that I gave in 1999 to U.S. high-income individual investors, a random sample throughout the U.S. And I think it shows a remarkable situation of overconfidence. One first question, do you agree the stock market is the best investment for long-term holders who can just buy and hold through the ups and downs of the market? If you add 1 and 2, strongly agree and agree somewhat, 96%. If you look at disagreement, adding 4 and 5, only 2% disagree. This is quite remarkable because I think there's lots of other investments that people have liked in the past, like real estate or gold or something else. Now it's the stock market. Next question, if there is another crash like 1987, the market will surely be back up to its levels in a couple of years or so. 91% agreement, only 6% disagreement, which is quite remarkable since the finance professors have been lecturing for the last 20 years that the stock market is a random walk. So you would have to answer strongly disagree. That's the correct answer, right? And finance won. If the Dow dropped 3% tomorrow, I would guess that the day after tomorrow, the Dow would increase 56%, decrease 19%. So it's 3-1. I asked the same question in 1989, and it was almost equally split between up and down. So there's no real mystery why the market is valued so highly now. People think they can't lose. This is the standard thing that, I don't know if they fully believe it, because otherwise they would all be 100% stocks. But an increasing number of people are 100% stocks. Okay, so let me just say, I'm not going to cover all these points. I want to open to questions. Let me just say something about the cultural factors. I argue in the book that the media are fundamentally important, the news media, to speculative bubbles. But it's not just because of, as we might imagine, because of the reporting of objective facts. It's because they're the shapers of stories. The markets generate news, data, millions of observations of data. None of us can comprehend this data itself. It has to be interpreted for us. The news media are story writers. They're attention grabbers. It's a competitive business to survive as a newspaper or magazine or whatever. You have to attract attention. And if you write boring stories or stories that people are interested in, you disappear. So the effect they have is to generate things like new era theories that come up. As far as new era theories, I did a nexus search of English language publications, and I looked for stories that had the word new era economics, which appeared around 1997, and then were widely cited in the media. Every one that I found mentioned the stock market. You don't see stories about the new era that don't mention the stock market. Because people, I think, are not interested in some economist coming on and saying the growth rate is going to be higher. Who cares, you know? I mean, that's boring. You're interested in somebody who's going to tell you you're going to be rich, right? Or you're going to make a lot of money. And in fact, the whole media have changed their tilt. They've changed the business. In many cases, they changed the name of the business section from business to your money. And they've changed the way they write articles that try to tell you. They used to write boring articles like Ford Motor Company opens new wing of River Rouge plant, right? And you know, who reads that? Well, it's guys who work in the auto industry and look at plants or something. Now they don't say it. Now they say, analysts say this is a buy opportunity for Ford stock. Okay, psychological factors. I just mention a few things that psychological research has done that makes, I think, my view of irrational exuberance more plausible. One of is something that psychologists call anchoring. And that refers to a tendency when forced to make ambiguous judgments, people anchor their answers on anything, something. And they don't may realize that they're being influenced by... let me tell you what a famous experiment that psychologists Kahneman and Tversky did. They asked people to answer difficult questions, such as, what percent of African nations belong to the United Nations? All right, now most people don't know that. In fact, they have no idea on that. But then they said, wait a minute, don't answer yet. We're going to spin a wheel of fortune, which is one of those quiz show wheels that generates a random number from 1 to 100. And then they say, okay, you see this number? Now tell me your answer. Now, the people's answers were heavily influenced by the wheel of fortune. And that's because they had no, obviously. So the same thing is true with the Dow, for example. The Dow is at 10,800. You know, I'll believe it, you know? I mean, it could be 4,000, it could be 20,000, and we'd believe it, but that's not the number that's showing. Another thing is overconfidence. Psychologists have documented that there is a syndrome called inferiority complex, which is there are people who think that everyone else is better than they are and don't trust their own judgment. However, these people are outnumbered by the other side, the overconfident side. I won't refer to the research in detail, but it's, I was struck in the October 1987 crash. I asked people, one of the questions was, did you think at any point that you knew when the market would rebound? And about 30% said yes. The next question was, why did you think you knew it would rebound? And the essay answers that I read were, I would describe, insipid. People couldn't write it convincing. They said it was intuition, gut feeling, or my judgment of the psychology. Another thing is attention. That psychologists have reported that people's attention, think of the errors that you've made in life, and very often they're due to inattention. It's an important faculty of human intelligence that we can direct our attention appropriately, but there are limitations to it. There's also a social basis to attention, that we tend to pay attention to what other people are paying attention to. Now, there may be some evolutionary advantage to that, but it's also a limitation. So, I don't know, in the U.S., I don't know if you followed this, after the O.J. Simpson trial got started, it seemed like everybody was paying attention. If you know O.J. Simpson, have you heard this? Well, anyway, Princess Diana, you must have heard of. And I'll tell you, in the U.S., she was on everybody's mind for quite a while. So the same thing happens with regard to lots of other things, and notably, the stock market. And right now we're in a phase in which there is incredible public attention to the stock market, and you can hardly avoid it. I like to play a game with my wife when we're eating out at a restaurant to keep one ear cocked for the word stock market. And usually, one of the adjacent tables, someone will talk about the stock market. So that's the situation we're in now. So I'll stop with that now. And I'll put my favorite slide back up. That's this one. And ask if there are any questions, comments. Yes.
You were talking about the stock market crash. I've got two questions. First of all, the stock market crash in 1987. You didn't mention one argument that many people attributed that to the crash, which was the feature of stop losses, and that many trading firms had certain stop losses were built up over the weekend, which then opened on Monday with a major sell.
Yeah. April of what year now?
This year. On the precise moment when the NASDAQ composite broke into 50,000 to 5,000 for the first time. And that precise minute, the Dow dropped like 250 points. Just the second the composite broke. Which kind of makes one argument for the prominence of the stop loss being an ultimate factor.
I'll repeat the question. Maybe I should answer your first. Yeah, he asked about stop loss, which is an order that you place that if the price goes down, automatically your broker sells. Arguing that stop loss behavior was important in 87. I agree. Well, I actually did mention it in a form. I mentioned portfolio insurance, which is a sort of stop loss. There are a lot of people in 87 who decided in advance that if the price goes down a certain amount, they will sell. And that's feedback, but it's a kind of a very specific kind of feedback that where someone formalizes it. But it's really the same thing. And the other thing is another kind of feedback through margin credit, which was emphasized in the 29 crash and has also been in effect lately. If you buy on margin when price goes down, the price goes down, then you might be forced to sell. Those are automatic feedbacks, and they're part of the picture.
To what extent do you think that other sciences outside the sphere of economics, whether it's social science or the sciences that are coming out of the Santa Fe Institute, complexity, etc., Santa Fe, complex systems, etc., how they can help us in mapping human psychology? There are phenomena in social science, such as moral panics, mods and rockers, or problems panics about GM foods or whatever. The satisfy certain criteria which also seem to be paralleled in the financial markets.
So
how could other social sciences help economy?
I was just at the Santa Fe Institute, and there's a bunch of physicists there who believe in modeling complex dynamics. I think there is something to their view, which there's this thing called chaos theory in mathematics, which is really a theory about feedback. Nonlinear feedback loops can generate very complicated patterns. And these are of great interest to physicists. I think there's something to that. There's also a lot of other social sciences that are relevant. Yeah, sociology, psychology, anthropology, history. And the problem is that you have to kind of think of all of these in order to really understand.
Would you be for a...
Well, I should go on to someone else.
Can I take this question at the back over here, please?
Isn't there a more, slightly more prosaic explanation of recent events in the stock market, which is... the novelty factor. That's to say, if you look, for example, at the FT 500, the leading 20 companies, and one very striking difference between now and a couple of decades ago is that over half the top 20 companies didn't exist.
Okay, well, that's an interesting point.
And yeah. What that means is inherently greater difficulty in valuing these new companies and new activities, which tends to lead to a slight over-optimism, perhaps,
right.
But also a genuine rise in the new economy. And without that, there would, in fact, already been a considerable stock market crash. So do we need the complex explanations?
Well, I believe that we do need the complex explanations because there's no one explanation. I think you're talking about another factor. Actually, Alan Greenspan has commented on this factor. He referred to something called the lottery principle, which is the principle that those who run state lotteries have observed, that you get much more interest in the public if there's a small probability of an enormous gain. And he thought that that's what's going on in the market now. Nobody knows whether this new economy stuff is true, but they do know that it sounds like you might make a lot of money. So it's suddenly gotten much more interesting. And that's, I think, part of what you're saying. A lot of companies have been developed that are not making profits. They're getting their foothold, but they imagine, the story is that they will have this phenomenal success. And the World Wide Web sounds, it makes it seem again plausible that they might. And that makes it attractive.
Of the top 20 established companies that are making very good profits and have good valuations, over half didn't exist 15 years ago. Now, that was quite a different situation, yeah. The economy in the 1950s and 60s, when most of the companies had been there since the 1920s.
Okay, I'll buy that. I'll put that as a 13th factor. And if you think of more, too, that's the thing. People come up with more. I should.
Okay, Phil.
How are we doing this? Oh, you've got the mic, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. I'm intrigued by the points you make among your courses of.
They just go off.
It's gone off?
No.
I must cover that. Of mutual funds and defined contribution pension funds. Are you making a contrast with, say, in the 1980s when we had more defined benefit and the professional money managers were more relatively important compared with the household sector?
Yeah, in the United States, there was an important revolution in 1981 when they created what's called a 401k plan. That was not allowed outside of academia, this kind of thing where each employee has his own contribution to a fund. And as a result, it's actually a government subsidy to that and encourage everyone to participate. And then the other thing about in the United States, the lawyers told the companies that set up 401k plans, don't ever say anything about whether it should be invested in stocks or bonds or whatever, because you're liable if it's wrong. So companies presented their employees with, you can choose between a growth fund and a value fund and an S&P fund and a bond fund. And then the employees said, what is this? You know, most people had never invested. They had to learn about stocks, and they had to start talking about stocks, and that's part of the phenomenon. Now, the 401k plans didn't, or the defined contribution plans, didn't necessarily have any tilt towards stocks, but in practice, that's the way it worked out. And it also taught people about mutual funds. And there are now more mutual funds than there are stocks. There's tremendous public interest in them, and it was partly they learned about them through the pension plans. Back there.
You mentioned what your wife said about the tendency of people on every other table in the restaurant to be talking about the stock market. I don't know whether you've noticed, but in this country, nearly every table is talking about the price of houses, an investment which competes very strongly with the stock market. Is the same not true of your country?
Yes, that's very interesting. The price of housing has interested me a lot, too, and I've done questionnaire surveys about that. I did with Chip Case at Wellesley College, we did a survey in California in 1988 when there was an enormous boom. And we asked people, how often do you talk with your friends about the housing market? We compared it with Milwaukee, which we picked because it was the most dead housing market in the country. There's a striking difference. In California, everyone was talking, and in Milwaukee, nobody was talking about housing. And then we asked, what do you think is the outlook for housing per year for the next 10 years in California, in your area, which is Los Angeles or San Francisco? And the median answer was like 15% a year. And we said, and in Milwaukee, it was very low. So they had this tremendous expectation. And then we said, how much risk is there in investing in housing? And in California, well, they both agreed there wasn't much risk. But of course, as you know, prices fell 30% in California after that. So, and it was the same thing. We asked people why they thought prices were going to go up. And we got insipid answers again, the same thing. You ask a Californian, why is the real estate market going to do so well? They'll say, because San Francisco has only so much land. They're not going to get any more land. It's got to go up. That sort of thing. No coherent explanation. So we see the same thing in real estate. Now, the interesting question is what's going to happen now. I guess London real estate prices are going up. And in the U.S., they're going up. San Francisco, we have data. My company has data. Prices went up 22% in San Francisco last year alone. And it's an incredible boom. And it's partly due to, you know, Silicon Valley is not far away and all this high-tech stuff. It's probably part of the phenomenon. people are reacting to the stock market boom and in the housing market.
There's a question over here. Then I'd like to, if the guy with the mic at the top could make sure the speakers at the top are given a chance. So
who are we?
Can we go over here to this gentleman, then we'll deal with some people off the top layer.
Yes, Professor Schiller. What about the...
Is that on? Yeah.
Is this on? The deflationary effects which we've been going through. In this country, since 1975, we've been in a period of deflation, which
you
not
mean
many...
declining inflation?
Deflation.
You're talking about what now?
We've overcapacity in lots of goods, which a lot of people know about, a lot of intelligent people. People who are making major decisions with large amounts of money. I would imagine 3/4 of the present Western world industry is in an overcapacity situation. And people realize that profits are going to be extremely hard to make in the established businesses over the next 10 years. So the effect of looking into tomorrow is what's caused that graph to go where it has.
Well, I don't have any dire outlook like that for making profits in the next... I mean, I kind of think that earnings are going to probably continue along more of the same trajectory that they have.
I cannot see it with the overcapacity there is in the world.
Could we take a question off the top, please?
The efficient market hypothesis, which you said you're a half believer in, with respect to an information set. Now, if we take the present stock market shooting up to be kind of symbolic of people taking into account more information, in the sense of people are the greater fool theory, that people know that other people are going to keep on buying stocks, and that's the general optimism is in the market. There's been a stupendous growth over the 5 years. So can we, in that essence, if we take that broader information set, not say that this is still rational expectations, that people are rational in expecting that the stock market will go up because of the following reasons? I mean, the reasons are more broad-based. So what would you have to say about that?
It sounds like you're referring to something that, say, George Akerlof calls near rationality. We're rational about, or maybe Keynes' beauty contest. You know what I'm referring to.
Yeah.
He said that we're all trying to predict not earnings, we're trying to predict others' behavior. In fact, we're not, as Keynes said, we're not really trying to predict others' behavior. We're trying to predict what other people think other people's behavior is going to be. That's the essential absurdity of financial market. I wouldn't call that efficient markets. That's maybe near rational or near efficient in some sense, but it's basically psychological. But I think you're getting at a real question that is on people's minds, and that is they think that this confidence now in the new economy or in the stock market is so ingrained that they can't see it going away. Mm-hmm. And so there's a feeling that even if we think it's crazy, the market is still going to stay up here, and they may see it growing even further. And there's also supporting suggestions that maybe some of the factors, those 12 factors that are driving the market, are still growing. Notably, the internet. I don't know what the number of worldwide users. In the United States, there's over 100 million adult users, but they predict within 5 years it will go up to 170 million. And outside of, in the rest of the world, there's a lot of people who are just beginning to use the internet. And so this is going to swell, obviously, over the next 5-10 years. And it might encourage the market up even more. So that gives some uncertainty about. But getting back to the confidence level, I think that confidence itself, even though it is expressed now on my questionnaires, and it appears to be an entrenched belief, over a period of years, I think we can expect it to erode. So I'm not expecting, the mindset that we have in 5 years or 10 years is going to be very different. And it's unpredictable. Other things will grasp our attention. We'll forget about the market. And so we'll forget about this view that it has to go up. So I think the kind of story I think that's plausible is that we just won't stay in this hyper state. And the plausible story might be that the market stays where it is for 10 years. You get poor returns with a dividend yield in the U.S. of 1%. You have to understand that a situation of enormous confidence is not likely to be sustained over 10, 20 years, which is the horizon of a long-term investor.
We'll take the question from the chap on the top, and then there's a chap at the back. Have you still got a question? Can you give a microphone over here, please?
Can you comment on the growing trend to indexation in both mutual and institutional funds?
Okay, you're referring to indexing to stocks. I mean, having a mutual fund that tracks a market index. And it's especially grown. There was this 1993 innovation at the American Stock Exchange called SPIDERS, in which you could actually trade a basket of stocks like a stock. And the story recently has been that that's expanding rapidly over the world. One view of this is that some of these index stocks are broad market basket indexes, like the indexes S&P. And one view of this is what the finance profession has been telling people. You should diversify widely. You shouldn't invest in individual stocks because, according to efficient markets, you can't pick them anyway. It's more efficient for you just to invest in an index. However, actually, growth in index stocks, mutual funds that are tied to indexes, has been largely in the specialty funds, like a technology fund or something like that. So it's not so much that of, you know, doing the really broad indexation. And anyway, I don't think you are right to think that one should invest in a broad index of stocks right now. So I don't know if that answers your question. It seems like the growth of indexation now is substantially people trying to make sector plays, and they're interested in investing in a group of stocks that share some characteristic, and that reflects part of the market psychology at the moment.
Thank you. The back here.
You showed us that the market has gone up, but since you're called Dr. Doom, could you please tell us if or when the stock market goes down?
Incidentally, this is a difficult time for me to, well, maybe it's a good time, actually. The NASDAQ last week made a record one-week gain. It went up 19% in 1 week. Today, it's been going down a little bit, so that's over. I was worried that it's going to keep going up. But actually, you should never worry, because it shows this seesaw pattern forever. The market is always going up and going down, day to day. And it's so confusing to people, because we have an impression from the media that there are these big events when the market suddenly changes. So, you know, they talk a lot about days, like October 28, 1929, or October 19, 1987. But it's never clear that anything definitive has happened and what we'll do tomorrow. But I think that's the kind of thing that I picture happening. A plausible scenario is that over the next 5 or 10 years, we'll just see prices up and down, but we'll see a few more down days than we see up days. And so eventually, after 10 years have gone by, we'll say, how did we get to Dow 8,000, you know, or whatever? And there will always be people saying, well, it's just going to go right back up. This drop from 2000 to 2010 was just a correction, and it's going to rebound. We'll always be in that kind of confused state. But I think it's plausible that the downs will outnumber the ups.
There's somebody on the right at the back. No? Yes?
Evening. Thank you.
Yeah, just shout.
Given that most people, as you say, believe the stock market can only go up, and given in your book you actually say that most of your precipitating factors have been discounted in the market, and also given in your book you make a case that news events don't actually trigger a big market reaction, how could you actually get a negative feedback loop starting just on your own argument?
Well, I think it starts because the attention to various of these factors is lost. I mean, the thing about downward feedback, downward and upward, is that we never understand them even after they happen. It's not as if some news event is going to create it, although news events might well play a role. But the market, getting back to the Santa Fe view that you mentioned, it seems to feed on itself. And price movements generate, it's really an absurd situation that price movements generate further price movement. So See, the kind of upward feedback loop, I didn't elaborate on it too much, that we've seen over the last 5 or 10 years operates through many channels. It's not just the confidence. It's kind of that price movements that we've seen generate attention to facts. I mentioned the fact that the stock market has always outperformed other investments. New kinds of leaders and heroes appear when the market changes. A downward feedback loop could easily come about, partly because people making their guesses and their intuitive trades create a downward price movement. Some newspaper story appears interpreting this as they bring up something that we already know but we've forgotten about. And then that generates an information cascade, where a sequence of other news stories come out. And it's not something we understand very well, but I think it's very plausible that this will happen.
Question at the back.
Just going back to the one of the prior questions about indexation, it seems that one of the most powerful arguments in favor of efficient markets at the stock selection level is that after n number of years, the percentage of funds that outperform in each of those years is expressed as a decimal 0.5 to the power of n, i.e. it approximates to tossing a coin. I wondered if you could comment on that.
There's a literature going way back arguing that professional investors who you might think would be smarter should outperform the market. And it goes back to 1933. Alfred Coles published in Econometrica a study showing that professional investors don't beat the market. More recently, however, people have done this more carefully, and there are some studies. For example, Kent Womack in the Journal of Finance in 1996, and there's a more recent paper by Brad Barber and other authors, in which they look carefully at if you took random analysts and took their advice immediately, when they give a buy recommendation, you buy, and when they give a sell recommendation, you sell. You got to do it immediately. Then you do actually, if you disregard transactions costs, you do actually do pretty well. It works. So what the analysts are saying has value. That seems to be an established fact. But you can't, they change their buy and sell recommendations so often that you would be eaten up by transactions costs. But maybe that's kind of what you expect. It's, you know, they are professionals and they are smart. But they tell this advice to so many people, and they don't have a monopoly on this information. So kind of the information gets out pretty fast. And maybe that's on a day-to-day basis. They're trying to make a profit. It's not surprising to me that markets in that sense would be roughly efficient.
I think we'll take a question off the top. And then there was somebody over here. Yeah. Okay. Then down here.
If you could respond to some thoughts from someone who takes a different view from you and who has been fully invested since 6,000 irrational exuberance and day traded. The thoughts are very briefly that your advice at the end of your book to sell, basically, presumably would have been your advice at 6,000 and it would have been completely wrong then. Secondly, that with regard to the barons...
I didn't write the book in 1996.
With regard to the barons, which I get, there are a lot of us who use it as a contrarian indicator very successfully.
Barons?
The barons newsletter, which a lot of us get, we use it as a contrarian indicator. And when you appear on the front, it's fantastic news for us because we know we're going to make money. And lastly, as a kind of another different perspective on why this might have happened, you have a view which is interesting, which is that there have been enormous technological inventions which you have commented on, and you compare them each to the World Wide Web. A lot of us see all of those together as a very long industrial revolution, and we see a new digital revolution starting with the invention of the computer, which is what you're comparing it with. And it's not just
to the... So many questions, I don't remember them all.
They were just comments. And so the comparison is not with the internet, with the television and the car. It's to do with a very, very broad 150 years of an industrial revolution with a much quicker digital revolution.
The first thing about... I was in the market from 1982 to around 1996, and then I didn't get out until 1998. So I gave predictions for 5 or 10 years when I testified in 96, but I didn't really say then that you should drop out. And even if I did, I think the public is wrong to flock to those people who, you know, there's a lot of people giving forecasts, and the media like to go to the guy who is closest to right. But that's an absurd strategy for picking pundits, because there's always going to be, you know, people are giving all sorts of forecasts, and if you take the guy who was closest to being right the last time, you're going to get someone that's more or less at random. As far as barons goes, Alan Abelson has been a bear for many years. He writes the column at the beginning. So, well, I guess that is a contrarian indicator, but... now I'm losing what you what was the thrust of his last of your last I told you I couldn't remember all three. Oh, that's right. Yeah, there's no one who can be precise about this. There are people who try to do estimates of the importance of the internet. For example, there was a Goldman Sachs study that said recently that B2B internet ought to raise GDP by about 5% by 2020. So that's about 0.25% a year growth due to B2B internet. And the B2C is not really, it's harder to judge. It's more like giving you more choice than causing growth. So that you compare that. So that's one estimate. That sounds plausible to me, that GDP will be 5% higher overall in 20 years. Does that mean that the market should have tripled? I don't think so. I mean, the question is who gets the benefit from all this. It could be labor that will get the benefit. Well, but yeah, now computers were invented in the 19th century, and they've been gradually growing in importance over the last century. There's always a sense that there's some spectacular breakthrough right around the corner. I quote in my book a newspaper article that was written January 1st, 1901. The beginning of the 20th century, and it had forecasts for technology of the future, and I thought it was quite remarkable to see what they were forecasting. For example, in this article they said, before long, newspaper publishers will be able to sit in a control room and push buttons, and the whole newspaper will be printed automatically. And then they also said that department stores, before long, will have phonograph records playing the sales pitch, and automatic hands will make change. This is 1901. And so there was this sense of great technology coming soon. It almost sounded like it was predicting computers, though it obviously didn't use the word. But these things actually happen over a gradual and slow... I think the most important thing about the digital revolution is that it's so visible. But again, I can't prove that, because it's a matter of judgment that's very hard to be systematic about. You have to compare this technological revolution with the revolution of many other things. Now, there's this famous literature about railroads that Albert Fishlow and Robert Fogel. Robert Fogel said that railroads enhanced our GDP by 1890 by about 5%. And he did this through a careful study of how much it would cost if you didn't have railroads to ship by other means. And he concluded it was only 5%. So then Al Fishlow said, wait a minute, you're not considering capacity limits and other things, and he made this big study, and he said it was 15%. So people tend to average the two and say, well, railroads raised GDP by 10% until it was wiped out by cars and airplanes and other things. It's awfully hard, but when people do these careful studies, they usually get, I mean, for these, you know, they get something like that, 5, 10. It seems plausible to me that the digital revolution is going to do something like that. But again, it's hard to... ultimately, incidentally, if we're talking 10, 20, or 30 years, it seems to me that the computer is going to transform our society in many ways. And it's not going to be just the web. It'll be robotics and things like that. But who the winners and losers are is very hard to predict. And I wouldn't say that we should conclude from this that the stock market should be really high. Maybe we should conclude that this is wonderful for less developed countries or for somebody, who knows. But why do we think automatically that it's existing companies? I think it's more wishful thinking generated by the feedback. If you really understand why lots of people are thinking that, it's because they've observed the stock market. They want to be optimistic. They like to read stories that reinforces this. It's not because that there was this sudden realization about technology. But anyway, that's my view. We can't prove it.
I think that the chap on the left, the young one.
Yes, for a UK investor, one could buy a FTSE all-share tracker with a P ratio of about 30, or an S&P 500 tracker with a P ratio of early 30s, or one could lend money to Gordon Brown for 29.5 years, percent, which implies a P ratio of about early 20s for something that will never go up in value. Now, for the vast majority of us, what should we invest in? You may well be right about the height of the stock market, but the alternatives don't seem terribly good.
This is a very common view. People say this is another part of the culture. I don't mean to accuse you of being part of the culture, but that is a very common thing, that there is no, the stock market is the only game in town. There's no other investment that's exciting or, it puzzles me. In the U.S., the Standard & Poor Index has a dividend yield of 1%. And our version of the index-linked gilts, which are doing, they're yielding 4%. So I don't see how you can say that the stock market, which is risky and yielding 1%, is obviously better than something that's riskless in inflation-corrected bonds that are paying 4%. But I know the feeling that, I think part of what this feeling that the stock market is the only game in town has something to do with a lot of emotional factors that one of them is this lottery principle that I mentioned earlier, that people, it's the only investment that I can think of that's going to, has a chance to make you really rich. And when you have people talking Dow 100,000 or whatever, you know, at least you know that there's somebody who thinks this is like a lottery ticket, it might make me rich. And there's other reasons why emotionally the stock market seems the only game in town. It's partly because the recent experience of so many of us is that some of our friends have made a lot of money. You know, maybe made more money in the stock market than I made working at my job last year. And so I'm in kind of emotional turmoil about that. I feel a little bit like a loser or something. And all my friends are talking about stocks now. And it's an activity. You know, I get on the web, and now the websites have all this information. And I want to be part of the hip culture, you know, I want to be able to talk about stocks anyway, so I want to play along. There's so many different motivations that make it seem like, you know, it really is what I want to do, is invest in stocks. And investing in bonds or whatever sounds like the dullest activity. It's going to make me, I'm not going to be popular. I won't have anything to talk about at dinner. So there's so many reasons.
There's a whole host of hands gone up. I think this chap actually at the top.
We're in a new era with everyone investing through the internet and a large number of many more people than previously involved in the stock market. What do you predict the social consequences of a fall in the stock market, and how do you see the U.S. government responding to that? In other words, will that buffer a fall in the market?
Will what?
Will it buffer? Will it correct? Yeah. Tend to correct?
Well, that's an interesting question about what the government will do if there's a major fall. Incidentally, this, you know, you can talk about bad scenarios as possibilities. We have this really high confidence, so everyone in the U.S. has gone out and bought a sports utility vehicle. You're well aware driving those so many of these on the road. Now they've got that one. Now if their confidence erodes, they don't need to buy another car. I could easily see a recession coming because of this. It could be... And there are also these income redistributions that are caused by that, that some people put, there are a lot of people who are so confident, or they still feel that it has to go up, that they've put all of their retirement savings in the market. And if the market, and they didn't pay off the mortgage on their house because they wanted to put it in the market. So they've got a mortgage on the house, and then if they invested it in risky stocks, they don't have anything. And unfortunately, this is a tragedy that goes beyond the person that made decisions, because the rest of the family might be involved. Now the question is, will Alan Greenspan or someone like that try to support the market? Now he seems to be saying no. Well, he's in the 1987 crash, they cut interest rates in order to support the crash, support the market. And there's been rumors that the Treasury, U.S. Treasury, would use the Exchange Stabilization Fund to buy stock. I don't believe that. I don't think that they will take such steps, but I don't have inside knowledge.
Okay, we'll take two more questions. There was a question at the front here, I think.
Yeah, in the book you put forth the view that corrections tend to occur gradually rather than suddenly. And when Galbraith looked at the crash of 1929, he came to the conclusion that they tend to occur very suddenly. And that would be consistent with 87.
Well, you're talking about this. The question is, this sudden? If you look closely, it dropped a lot from 1929. This was the initial crash. And then if you can see this little, well, actually, this is September of 29. October is right about there. It drops down. It comes back up April 10, 1930, to right where it was before October. And then it dropped. This took 2 more years to get down here. And I don't know if you call that sudden. It was sort of sudden. It was almost 3 years from top to bottom. As I was saying, over this whole period, there were all these reversals. Every time one of these reversals occurred, people thought, phew, at last, now it's going back up. But they couldn't understand why it just kept, they kept getting reversed. There were more downs than ups. So that is the story which Galbraith must have understood when he wrote that book. Did he say it was a one-day?
What about the occurrences of like very sudden drops since his, such as 29 and 87.
Yeah, a sudden one-day drop then becomes part of the culture. And it's really remarkable that the 1929, well, the one-day drop, October 28, 29, 1929, are so well remembered. In fact, the mythology has developed around it, which isn't even true. As Galbraith points out in that book, people, what is the standard mythology? That a lot of people jumped out of windows? Well, he points out that the suicide rate did not go up. That is a myth that has developed. And so it has become a cultural icon. And in fact, I think this crash is very important because it's our model for a crash. And people think, well, that could happen again. And in fact, that model is repeatedly brought to our attention. And I thought it was quite striking that move forward to 1987, which is right there, October 19, 1987, and the Wall Street Journal on the morning of October 19th, there was a plot which had this brought up to this, and it showed superimposed the 1929-32 crash on where we were right now. And that was in the morning paper. And then the funny thing is that the actual drop on October 19th was almost exactly the same as the drop on those 2 days together between here. You can see it. You can see here and here. It's the same, right? Now, it seems to me, what caused the October 1987 crash to take the form that it did? Again, this is very uncertain because we're talking about people playing this strange game of trying to guess what you are going to do or what you think I'm going to do. Somehow it worked out to repeat very much the same drop that was seen back then. And I think maybe the fact that it was talked about so much right before it happened has something to do with the similarity. If you look at, there's lots of other events here that you could single out. Look at them all. You know, they could have been writing stories about this one, right? But nobody was, this is totally forgotten, and the public consciousness is centered so much on this one. It's part of our culture, and that's the view I have, that the culture drives the market.
There's a question back here.
Yeah, could you comment on the effect of monetary policy on stock prices? The conventional wisdom is in Japan, the monetary policy was too relaxed at the bubble period.
I'm sorry, the monetary policy.
Japan's financial bubble was at least partly due to the expansionary monetary policy. In the United States, it seems to me there are two schools of thoughts. One is like in Japan, the monetary policy has been too relaxed, and the Federal Reserve has not tightened enough to stave off financial bubble. But there's quite another argument that the Federal Reserve has been too successful in containing inflation and inflation expectation, that has reduced risk premium for the financial asset investment. That has increased stock prices. What do you think of that?
I've actually heard Alan Greenspan express that view, that he wonders, I don't remember exactly, that the fact that they saved the market in 1987 has created a false sense of confidence. And his recent speeches have tried to pull back from that to say, don't assume that I'm going to support the market. And in Japan, in the 1980s, there was a lot of view that the Ministry of Finance would save any market crash. that was something that was supporting the market back then. So as far as monetary policy in the U.S. goes, it seems to me that I think market analysts put too much stress on it. When you watch, you don't have CNBC here, right? You see it when you come to the States. There's a parade of analysts that are constantly appearing on this TV station. And when asked to comment on the market, the first thing they think of is saying, well, I think the Fed is going to raise interest rates by 50 basis points. And if it does, you know, as if that was the important thing for the market. But actually, the Fed, and I assume monetary authorities around the world are similar, they're pretty predictable. And so trying to forecast what they're going to do is not the essential thing that we should be doing when we're trying to predict the market. I mean, Alan Greenspan could trash the economy, or any central bank could trash the economy by pushing up interest rates, but they're not going to do that. And so they become part of the fixtures that we don't have to worry about too much.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Extremely interesting talk. I'd like to thank, obviously, the LSE and Princeton University Press. Thank you.